He had to admit that here in bed it didn't sound quite so logical, but when he thought back to the scene on the road, the black trees illuminated only by the flashing lights of the patrol car, the covered body on the ground, the blood on the dirt, the staring crowd, he could not help feeling a twinge of queasiness. They were both silent for a while. "I'm glad," Maureen said quietly. He'd thought she'd fallen asleep. He was about to doze off himself, and though the words came out of nowhere, had no context, he knew exactly what she was talking about. She rolled onto her side, facing him. "I'm glad he's dead," she said. Barry said nothing, not knowing what to say. "Does that make me a horrible person?" "No," he told her, and leaned over to kiss her forehead. "No, it doesn't." 12. They came over while Liz was taking a bath. Ray didn't know if that was intentional, but the idea that the house was under surveillance, that his and his wife's movements were being monitored, made him both uneasy and angry. He was near the entryway, and he opened the door at the sound of the knock. Neil Campbell stood on the welcome mat, Chuck Shea and Terry Abbey just behind him. As always, Neil carried a clipboard, and he nodded brusquely in his annoyingly officious manner. "We need to talk to you alone for a few minutes, Ray."
"Alone?"
"Yes." "How do you know I'm alone?"
"What do you mean, Ray?"
The innocence was a little too innocent.
"Where do you think Liz is?"
"I'm sure I don't know."
"She's in the bath, so I am alone. Pretty damn convenient."
"All I meant was that we would like to speak to you outside of the presence of your wife. I thought we might chat behind a closed door in some room of your house, but yes, the fact that Elizabeth is bathing at this time is quite fortuitous."
The uneasiness increased.
"What do you want?"
"May we come in?" Neil asked.
Ray favored him with a tight smile.
"No, you may not."
"Then we will conduct our business here on the porch."
"I have no business with you," Ray said. "As I've told you assholes before, get off my property."
They made no effort to move, and Chuck's mouth curved upward in an amused smile.
"You know very well that we're not trespassing. We have the right to be here."
"Why?"
"The association has been informed that you spoke with Sheriff Hitman," Neil said, "and attempted to discover the identity of the person who bailed the late Deke Meldrum out of jail."
"So? What business is that of yours?"
"When behavior of an individual reflects badly on Bonita Vista, the Homeowners Association naturally takes an interest. As you know, it is our goal to avoid tarnishing the reputation of our community and to do everything within our power to make sure that property values are maintained. Needless to say, the death of a man, even a transient, even by accident, is cause for concern."
"What does that have to do with my trying to find out who bailed out Meldrum?"
"We are simply trying to stave off potential embarrassment. It is clear from the questions you asked and from your past behavior that you are somehow trying to place blame for this man's death on the association, and we're here today to dissuade you from that course of action."
"Got something to hide, Campbell?"
Chuck stepped forward.
Ray, you still haven't learned that sometimes you need to just leave things alone. Let them be."
"Yeah, why is that?"
They moved fast, Chuck grabbing him by the left arm and pulling him out onto the porch, Terry stepping quickly behind him and yanking on his right arm. The two of them held him, while Neil thwacked his genitals with the clipboard. There was a sudden sharp flare of pain so intense that he wanted to cry out and clutch his balls, but he refused to give these bastards the satisfaction of a response, and he willed himself to remain stoic. Neil grinned, and there was real enjoyment in it. Malice and pleasure, a lethal combination. For the first time since he and Liz had moved to Utah, Ray was scared. Really and truly scared. A line had been crossed, and it was impossible to go back again, to pretend it hadn't occurred. Neil lovingly stroked the clipboard as he paced in front of the stoop.
"You're not a team player, Ray. Bonita Vista is a community, and you are part of that community. You and your wife are not hermits or recluses living on your own. You live here, with us, in respectable, civilized society." There was steel in his voice, in his eyes. You need to play ball.
Tell your goons to get their hands off of me.
Neil punched him in the stomach and Ray doubled over. He remained standing only because Chuck and Terry were holding him up, and he was humiliated to hear that the sounds he made while trying to suck in air sounded like sobs. Bonita Vista is your home, and you'd better start showing it more loyalty, more respect. The reason you have such a nice house in such a nice neighborhood is because of the standards maintained by the Homeowners Association, because of our vigilance in going after those who do not follow the rules and regulations. Your life is easy because we have made it easy. Yet you are ungrateful, always looking for the cloud behind the silver lining, always imagining nefarious schemes behind perfectly innocent efforts to improve life in our neighborhood.
It's a free country, Ray reminded him.
Neil smiled. Behind him, Chuck and Terry laughed harshly. A free country? Do you know why we have a homeowners association? Neil asked. It's because we are not under anybody's rule. The federal and state governments do not concern themselves with our petty little problems, and the county, even if it wanted to, doesn't have the means. We're in an unincorporated area, so there is no local government that has jurisdiction. We are on our own. We have been forced to provide for ourselves, to take care of ourselves, to look out for our own. And you're right, we are free. Free from government interference and meddling and micromanagement. But it is only our self-sufficiency that makes it so. It sounded like a militia attitude, particularly in the fervency of its delivery, and that was as scary to Ray as anything he had yet heard. This is true democracy, Neil said. It's not representative government, but direct participation. We, the people, are the ones making decisions and carrying them out. We're not relying on others, on outside assistance, and we're doing a damn good job of it. A homeowners association is more efficient than a government agency, more efficient and more responsive. This, he said, gesturing to the neighborhood around him with the clipboard, is the wave of the future. The decentralization of government that people have been fighting for years? We have it.
I'm a liberal Democrat, Ray said. I like big government.
Neil punched him again. The patina of politeness, the attempt to convert through persuasive argument, was gone, and Neil's voice was annoyed and angry. You're a slow learner, Ray, and we're not going to put up with this forever. Get with the program. We're here today as a courtesy call, to give you some friendly advice before you really get yourself into trouble. Ray could not breathe, but he managed to croak out a message of defiance.
Fuck you!
Chuck kicked him in the shins. Terry punched the back of his neck. Without the support of their hands, he crumpled to the ground, gasping. Neil said something he did not catch, and then all three of them were walking away, back up the driveway toward the road. He tried to stand up, and was only able to do so by balancing himself against the door jamb. He ached all over. They'd hurt him, he realized, in a way that would not show, and even if there were some law enforcement agency he could go to, there was nothing he'd be able to prove. He was filled with a deep, furious desire for revenge, but it was tempered by fear, by the more realistic assessment that these people were willing to go to any lengths to achieve their ends. Their ploy had worked, Ray realized. He had not been afraid before. Now he was. He was grateful, at least, that he had shown no fear, that he had been able to keep up his defiant bravado in front of those assholes, and he moved slowly and painfully back into the house, locking the door behind him and limping into the living room. He sat down hard on the couch, still trying to catch his breath. A few moments later, Liz emerged from the bathroom. Did someone stop by? I thought I heard voices. Ray shook his head. No, he said. He tried to smile.
It was just the TV.
13. The Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Covenants, Conditions, and Restrictions, Article 3, Land Use Classifications, Permitted Uses and Restrictions, Section 3, Paragraph L. Any member of the Architectural Committee, any member of the Board, or any authorized representative of such, shall have the right to enter upon and inspect any lot within the properties for the purpose of ascertaining whether or not the provisions of this declaration have been or are being complied with, and such persons shall not be deemed guilty of trespass by reason of such entry. 14.
Whatever it was that had initially turned her off to Bonita Vista seemed to have finally and completely died with Deke Meldrum. Maureen pulled the hose around the right front tire of the Suburban as she watered the replanted irises. She looked out at the road, looked up at the sky. She no longer had any reservations about being here, and contrary to expectations, she found that she liked living in a gated community, enjoyed the security such an extra layer of protection provided. She felt safe. Not because they were in rural Utah, away from the smog and the gangs and the high crime rate of the major metropolitan areas, but because they were living in Bonita Vista, an enclosed world, a hermetically sealed environment, shielded against all that lay outside. Her reservations had been turned on their head, and what she had originally thought of as drawbacks now seemed like attributes. Barry said that it was her accountant's side coming out, and though he'd meant it as a joke, perhaps there was some truth to that. She was neater than he was, more fastidious and methodical, more concerned with order and organization. It was a trait common to those who enjoyed working with numbers, just as comfort with chaos and disorganization seemed to be de rigueur for liberal arts people like Barry. And she had to admit that there was something reassuring about living in well-regulated surroundings. Usually, she was big on first impressions, and as old-fashioned and superstitious as it sounded, she was a firm believer in women's intuition, or at least her own intuition. She trusted her gut instincts, and it was rare that she changed her mind once an opinion had been formed. But change her mind she had, and it was Meldrum's death that had been the catalyst. It was as if he'd been the conduit for the negativity she'd had toward this place, and with his sacrifice, all of that had disappeared. His sacrifice? She didn't know where that had come from, but she didn't want to think about it. That was a remnant of those disgraced first impressions, a holdover from before, and she refused to acknowledge that it had any validity. There was nothing untoward about Bonita Vista, and neither the neighborhood nor the homeowners association had anything to do with that lunatic's death. It was an accident, pure and simple. Barry walked out of the house, sipping Dr. Pepper from the battered plastic Batman cup that had been his sole contribution to their kitchen supplies. "What are you doing?" he asked. "Watering." "No, I mean after that. Are you busy?" "Not really. Why?" "I thought we could check out the tennis courts, get in a little exercise. We're paying for those courts with our association dues. We should at least get our money's worth." It had been a long time since they'd played tennis. In the early days, when they were dating, when they were poor, they spent many a Saturday afternoon on the courts of the high school next to her old apartment. Neither of them were particularly athletic, however, and time and inclination had led them away from outdoor recreation. But playing tennis again sounded like fun, and she nodded enthusiastically. "Let's do it." "All right, then. Do you know where the rackets are?" "I put them in one of the garage boxes we have in storage. I'll cruise down and pick them up while you finish your watering." "Okay." She smiled and pulled on the hose as she moved to the next group of plants. "Prepare to meet your doom." "You never beat me once," he reminded her. "And I don't think 10 years of inactivity have improved your tennis skills." "Famous last words," she said. "Famous last words." She finished watering, and after Barry returned with the rackets and a can of balls, they walked down to the tennis courts. Located near the entrance of Bonita Vista, the better to impress outsiders and passers-by, the twin courts were perfectly maintained and surrounded by a high green chain-link fence meant to prevent balls from flying into the forest and to keep out non-residents. Inappropriately large stadium lights were mounted on street lamp-sized poles in order to illuminate the courts at night and allow evening play. They stepped up to the gate. An electronic lock with a small keypad was mounted above the latch. "Guess we should have read our handbook before coming down here," Barry said derisively. He handed Maureen the can of balls and bent forward to look at the metal square. "There aren't any instructions." He punched in the entry code for the community gate, but there was no response. "Try our address," Maureen suggested. "Or our lot number." The lot number did the trick, and the framed chain-link rectangle swung smoothly open. "Keeping track of who uses it," Barry said. "Nice." Maureen laughed.
You're as paranoid as Ray. She walked onto the green court, felt a slight give beneath her feet as she headed toward the net. It was a far cry from the faded lines on concrete that had defined the school court on which they used to play, and she was impressed that Bonita Vista had such a professional, state-of-the-art facility. She touched the taut net and walked around it to the other side. "Didn't Mike and Tina say that they played tennis?" Barry nodded. "Yeah? Maybe if we practice up a bit, we could play doubles with them." "Sure, in a year or two." "Speak for yourself." Maureen threw up a ball and hit it over the net to him. He returned the ball, but that was the end of their volley. She missed, swinging against air, and the ball bounced harmlessly, dead-ending at the fence. For the next several minutes, they took turns serving and missing, managing only an occasional return. "Still think we're good enough to play the Stewarts?" Barry called. "Let's get into it, Ryder boy. 4 out of 7. You serve first." They started playing. An actual game, not just random volleys. She noticed that he kept looking away from the court, out into the forest behind them, that he kept peering through the chain-link fence into the underbrush each time he picked up a ball. "Looking for Stumpy?" she teased him. He glanced up quickly, guiltily, as though she'd read his mind, and it was obvious that she'd hit the nail on the head. She'd been joking, of course, but she should have known better. Although he hadn't said much about Stumpy since that first day, she should have figured out that he'd be obsessing about it. A deformed man living in the wilds? That was right up his alley, and no doubt he'd conjured up some outrageous scenarios involving underhouse crawl spaces and perverse voyeurism, and pets that had been stolen and eaten. The truth, as she understood it, was not nearly so melodramatic. The limbless man was not malevolent, but harmless. Almost everyone seemed to have a Stumpy story, and most of them were pretty damn funny. Barry was right. It was sad that someone actually lived like that in this day and age. But on the other hand, from everything she'd heard, it was his own choice. He preferred to live that way, and apparently it made him happy. Barry picked up the tennis ball and moved back into place. "You think he's spying on us? Is that it?" "I think he watches," Barry said. "And I think he knows a lot. Stumpy has access to everything. He can go where he wants when he wants. If he could talk, I bet he'd have quite a story to tell." Maureen shook her head. "Just serve," she told him. He beat her 3-1, and despite the fact that they were only playing for fun, her natural competitiveness would not allow her to go down without a fight. She walked forward. "Switch. The sun's in my eyes." A likely story. Still, he let her trade sides, and she actually won the next game, despite the fact that he was serving. Then it was her turn, and she let fly a not particularly effective serve, but Barry did not even try to return the ball. Instead, he let it bounce behind him and moved toward the net, motioning for her to do the same. They met in the middle of the court. "Don't be too obvious, but look across the street. There's an old lady spying on us." She turned. On the other side of the road from the tennis courts was a house, a 2-story residence of wood and glass with twin front windows facing the road. She saw the curtains move, saw an elderly face peer out. "So, old people are always nosy. It gives them something to do, gossip about their neighbors." "It's not just that. She's been watching us intently, keeping track." "Maybe she's a tennis fan." Maureen turned back, saw the curtains move once more. On the road in front of the house, an equally old couple was walking by, taking a stroll. The woman smiled, waved at them, but the man spent too long looking, did not turn away, and it was clear that he was watching them, studying them. "See," Barry said. "There's something weird going on." "What?" "Face it, hon, this place isn't exactly a hotbed of activity in the middle of the week. We're probably the day's excitement." "It's not just that." He glanced around, as though searching for something. "I feel like we're under surveillance." His gaze traveled upward to the top of the fence, to the light pole. He frowned, moved around the pole, looking up. "Check that out," he said. "What?" "Up there, look." She followed his pointing finger. Mounted atop the light pole, aimed down, was what appeared to be a video camera. the type of security device found in banks and convenience stores.
See?
See what? It's obviously an anti-vandalism measure. A perfectly appropriate one, considering what happened to my flowers. He walked around the pole again.
Where does it go? He wondered.
Where's the monitor that it's attached to?
There probably isn't one. It's probably just a VCR.
But where? In the president's house?
He glanced up at the camera.
You telling me that thing doesn't have a zoom on it? That whoever's monitoring it doesn't use it to peek down Babe's tennis blouses?
Now you're just being crazy.
She looked at him.
Or is this some story idea you're trying out on me?
It's not a bad idea for a story, but no, I'm being serious.
You're overreacting.
Am I?
It's called security, and I have no problem with it. We have security gates here, security cameras. It's why our crime rate is almost non-existent. It's why people like to live here.
You sound like an advertisement.
Barry,
she shook her head, thought of saying something else, didn't.
Let's just play tennis.
But he wasn't ready to let it go.
What about that old lady peeking at us from behind her drapes? What about the people walking by?
I think it's nice, she said. They're watching out for us.
They're spying on us.
Isn't this what people are trying to recapture, this sense of community? This idea that everyone looks out for everyone else? Isn't that what they mean by the good old days?
But that was natural. It evolved on its own. It wasn't imposed on people.
We had a neighborhood watch in California, for Christ's sake. It's the same exact thing.
No, it's not the same thing. He walked over to where she had put the Voight can and dropped his ball inside. He picked up the can.
Let's go home, he said. I don't want to play anymore.
I do.
Fine, then play by yourself. But I'm going back. I'm not going to stay here to be monitored and spied on.
You're an asshole, she said.
They left together, walking in silence back up to the house. Maureen checked the mailbox on the way in, but it was empty. There was a piece of pink paper attached to the screen door, however, that was fluttering in the slight breeze and drew their attention. It was tucked into the top of the grating that covered the door's lower half, and they walked up the porch steps. Barry pulled out the paper and held it so they could both read. It was a form, obviously a duplicate of an original, and the heading at the top read, Exterior Maintenance Review. Beneath the heading was a short paragraph explaining that the Bonita Vista Homeowners Association Architectural Committee had conducted a review of the property and had determined that the subsequent maintenance was required. There followed a list of actions, two of which had check marks next to them. Paint chimney, chimney cap, and clean pine needles and cones. They'd been gone only half an hour or so, 45 minutes at the most, and it was hard to believe that in that time someone had inspected their house and lot for all of the possible violations listed on the form. It was also a little disconcerting. While she knew it was legal, she didn't like the fact that people had been on their property while they were gone, snooping around. There seemed something sneaky about it, something wrong. Why couldn't the inspection have been conducted while they were at home? But she didn't want Barry to know she felt that way. He was no doubt furious and incensed at such a violation of their privacy, and as petty as it was, she was glad. It served him right. He stared at the form.
Pine cones?
It was rather small and silly, she had to admit, and she had half a mind to call up Chuck or Terry and ask why they were being harassed for such minor details, but she was mad at Barry and wanted him to be irritated and annoyed.
I guess you're going to have to do some yard work, she said.
15. The day was beautiful, the blue sky filled with gigantic white clouds that drifted lazily from east to west, and Barry decided to ride outside on the deck rather than coop himself up in the house in front of the computer. If he came up with anything good, or anything usable, he could type it up later. He picked up his notebook, defiantly cranked up the stereo volume despite the fact that the music playing was an undefiant James Taylor, and pushed open the sliding glass door.
"Turn that down!" Maureen yelled from the bottom floor.
"I won't be able to hear it outside!" he shouted back.
"Buy a Walkman!"
Barry ignored her, went outside onto the deck, and settled into a chair, but he was not surprised when a moment later the music was abruptly cut off. There was a tap on the glass, and he glanced over to see Maureen grinning at him. "Thanks a lot," he said. "My pleasure." She returned downstairs to where she'd been working on the computer, and he turned his attention to the page before him. The blank page. He stared at the lined paper. Ever since they'd moved here, he'd had a scene from the movie Funny Farm stuck in his brain. In the film, Chevy Chase moves out to the country because he wants to write a novel, and in the initial tour of the new house with his wife, he finds a perfect room for his studio where there's a bird cheerfully chirping on a branch outside the window. Later, he's sitting at his writing desk in front of his typewriter and a blank roll of paper, completely blocked, and this time when the bird chirps happily outside, Chase throws a cup of hot coffee at it. That had been Barry's greatest nightmare, that he would be unable to write in these gorgeous surroundings, and even today, as he sat on the porch, pen in hand, there was the small nagging fear at the back of his mind that he wouldn't be able to come up with anything, that the creative juices wouldn't flow. But he needn't have worried. As always, he had no problem tapping his imagination, and soon his pen was flying, describing the feelings of a young boy forced by his psychotic sister to eat cereal made from the bone dust of their cremated mother. A woman walked by on the road in front of the house, and he caught her eye and waved. She gave him a thin smile, waved back, then hurried on, obviously eager to be away from him. So much for small-town friendliness. He looked at her retreating back. Now that he thought about it, the sociability quotient of their neighborhood seemed to have gone down over the past week or two, the dinner invitations they'd received upon first arrival no longer extended. He wasn't complaining. They had friends here now, Ray and Liz, Frank and his wife Audrey, Mike and Tina Stewart. But still it was odd, and he wondered why it had happened, whether they'd broken some unwritten code and made some hideous social faux pas, or whether their newness and novelty had worn off and everyone who wanted to meet them had done so. The woman rounded a bend in the road, disappearing behind the pines, and Barry looked down at his notebook, flexed his fingers one more time, and resumed writing. The weather changed quickly, as it often did here in Utah. He'd been sweating in the June heat, then suddenly thick white clouds blocked the sun, and there was a measurable drop in temperature, a full 8 degrees according to the Sierra Club outdoor thermometer Maureen had installed on the wall next to the door. The sweat cooled on his skin. If what Ray said was true, July would bring the monsoons, and then they'd really see some schizoid weather. Barry was looking forward to it. As a native Southern Californian, his exposure to different seasons had been through movies, books, and television, entirely secondhand, and it was nice to finally experience for himself the vagaries of Mother Nature. He broke off for lunch some 6 pages later, his right hand starting to cramp. He felt good about what he'd written this morning. If it went this well every day, he'd be able to write for 6 months out of the year and take the other 6 off, or crank out 2 books a year instead of one. Probably the latter. Writing was a notoriously fickle and unstable business, and no matter how well he was doing, there was always the possibility that he could be stone cold in a year and find his fiction unsaleable. It was the nature of the beast, and even if he hadn't had a borderline obsessive work ethic, he would still feel the need to strike while the iron was hot. But inspiration wasn't that consistent, and although there were days when he finished 20 clean pages, there were others when he eked out only a single paragraph that more often than not had to be rewritten the following day. This morning had been productive, though. Walking inside, he dumped his notebook on the dining room table and went into the kitchen, searching for something to eat. He opened the cupboards, looked through the refrigerator, but the house seemed to be devoid of snacks, and he was too lazy to actually make anything. He finally settled on an apple, chomping it as he walked downstairs. Maureen was in the bathroom, but on the table next to the computer were several stamped envelopes addressed to the IRS, entreaties on behalf of her clients, no doubt, and he called out between bites, "Hey, you want me to take these letters out to the mailbox?" "Go ahead," came the muffled response. Anxious to be walking, on the move, doing something physical after sitting on his butt all morning, Barry tossed his apple core into the waste paper basket, picked up the envelopes, and headed outside. At the mailbox, he flipped up the red flag and opened up the rounded metal door to drop off Maureen's outgoing correspondence. But he saw immediately that the box wasn't empty. Today's mail had not yet been delivered, so there were no bills, no letters, no postcards. But there was an unstamped envelope bearing his name, and in the upper left corner, the printed initials BVHA. Bonita Vista Homeowners Association. He ripped open the envelope, angry before he even knew what was in it. There was no form this time, but a typed note on letterhead stationery. He read the message. Read it again. Dear Mr. Welch, it has come to our attention that you have been using 113 Pine Top Road as your place of business as well as your primary residence. Bonita Vista is a strictly residential community, and all commercial or business activities are prohibited. No homeowner may practice his or her occupation on any of the properties. The board has only recently learned of your specific situation, and after careful review, we have determined that as per the Bonita Vista CC&Rs, you are required to secure an alternate site at which you can conduct your writerly vocation within 30 days of this notice. If you have any questions or concerns, please do not hesitate to call me at 555-7734. I would be happy to assist you in any way I can. Sincerely yours, Boyd R. Masterson, Committee Chair. The paper in his hand was trembling, he was so angry. Barry shoved Maureen's envelopes into the mailbox and shut the door. Writerly vocation. In his mind, he was revising and rewriting the letter, a pointless exercise, but one that he often did when confronted with adversarial documentation. Too many people in this world were unable to compose an effective missive, and it always gave him a boost to realize that his opponents were not as adept at composition as he was. It diffused the threat somehow, gave him, at least in his own mind, a psychological advantage. There was the sound of a vehicle coming up the road, and he looked up to see a red Jeep rounding the corner and starting up the hill. It was Mike Stewart. Mike worked in town at the Cablevision office and was obviously on his way home for lunch. He gave a honk and a wave as his Jeep passed by, but something in Barry's demeanor must have alerted him that something was amiss, because a second later Mike braked the vehicle and coasted back down, stopping in front of the driveway. "Anything wrong?" he called out. Barry walked up to the Jeep, holding out the letter. "What do you make of this?" Mike reached out the driver's window and took the paper from his hand. He started to read, then snorted. "Those assholes." "You know anything about this rule?" "No, but that's only because it doesn't apply to me. If they say it's in the CC&Rs, you can bet your mama's coos that it is." "But don't you think this rule was probably made to keep people from selling stuff out of their house, or setting up some sort of manufacturing unit in their garage, or doing things that would disrupt the neighborhood? I mean, I write, for God's sake. I type. That's it. It doesn't harm anything. No one would even know I'd do it if I hadn't told them." Mike sighed. "You're probably right, but these are letter-of-the-law guys. Intent doesn't mean shit to them. They're just into throwing their weight around and enforcing their rules. And the more infractions they find, the more people they can crack down on, the happier they are. They're grateful you slipped through that loophole and they could pounce." "God damn it!" "You know," Mike said, "it's my goal to win the lottery. There are quite a few empty lots up here, and if I won, I'd buy them all. Not just to keep the open space, but also because for each lot you own, you get one vote in the association election. I'd have a massive voting block, probably more than all the existing residents put together." He grinned. "I haven't decided whether I would vote to disband the Homeowners Association or just vote myself president and exempt myself and my friends from all existing rules while enforcing them to the max for everyone else." "That," Barry said, "sounds like a plan." "Lotteries every Wednesday and Saturday." Barry smiled. "I'm a friend, right?" "Damn straight. And I'll make those bastards pay for this." He handed back the letter. "But until then..." Mike grew more sober. "I think you're screwed." He held up a hand. "Don't go by what I say, though. I'm no expert on this shit. You should talk to a lawyer or something." "Yeah. Hey, I gotta get home and eat lunch. I only get a half hour and 15 minutes are gone already. I'll call you later." "All right. Thanks, Mike." Barry waved goodbye as the Jeep took off up the hill, and still clutching the letter in his fist, headed up the driveway and into the house. Maureen, after he'd told her, after she'd read the letter, didn't seem all that upset. At least, not as upset as he thought she should be. She agreed that it was unreasonable to force him to stop writing at home, but she admitted that she understood the logic behind it. They can't very well let you off the hook and make you the exception. They're obligated to apply the rules fairly and evenly, not pick and choose who they're going to harass. That would be selective enforcement, and there'd be lawsuits galore after that. I know it sucks that you fell through the cracks, but I don't think it's intentional. I don't think they're after you. I think they're just trying to enforce their regulations, as unfair as they are, in a way that proves they're not singling anybody out for prosecution or favors. Jesus Christ. It's not the end of the world. Thanks for the support. Maureen shrugged. All I'm saying is that it might not be all that bad for you to get an office. At least not from a tax perspective. The rent's deductible, that's not the point. I know that. I'm just saying that we're doing pretty well these days, and your business expenses are almost non-existent. That's why we took such a big hit last year on taxes. But if you got yourself an office... Stop trying to be practical and calm me down. I'm pissed off here. And goddammit, I have a right to be. Knock off the every cloud has a silver lining crap. Her mouth tightened. If I was retired, I could sit here all day and write crank letters to the newspaper or the government or whatever, and I wouldn't be breaking any rules. But because I make my living writing, I can do the exact same thing for the same amount of time, and suddenly I'm in violation of the regulations. Don't expect me to be happy about that. A thought suddenly occurred to him, and he took the letter from her hand, read it over again. "You know what?" he said. "It only mentions me. What about you? You're using this as your office, too. I'm not the only one working out of the house here." "And what's that supposed to mean? You're going to turn me in?" "Of course not." "What then?" "Nothing." "Then why'd you bring it up?" "Because they're not applying the rules fairly. Because they are singling me out." "So what are you going to do? Sue them over it?" "Threaten them with it, at least. You're right, it is selective enforcement. And maybe if I play my cards right, I can get a waiver." He had Maureen call Chuck Shea, her association buddy, to feel him out, to see if something could be arranged, a sort of don't-ask-don't-tell policy that would allow him to continue working at home. But Chuck said the work rule was hard and fast. The only exceptions were those explicitly spelled out in the CC&Rs, specifically real estate agents and accountants, who were not allowed to meet clients at home but were allowed to do paperwork, which was why Maureen had not been cited in the letter. Barry was the first writer to live in Bonita Vista, and it was conceivable that there could be an exception made for his occupation in the future, but Chuck said the matter would have to be brought before the voting membership at the annual meeting in September. Until then, he would have to abide by the rules. "Not selective enforcement after all," Maureen told him after relaying the message. And wasn't that a hint of triumph in her voice? No, he was being paranoid. He was angry at her, though he didn't really have any right to be. And he went upstairs to the kitchen to get himself something to drink and to calm down before he said something he might later regret. Afterward, he called Ray, who was of the same opinion as Mike. Underneath all the sympathy and sincerity and heartfelt offers of assistance, the association people were loving this. "Think I should talk to a lawyer?" Barry asked. He could almost hear Ray's shrug over the phone. "It's your call, but if I were you, I'd save my money. These CC&Rs have been challenged in court too many times to count, and they've survived every attempt made on them. You might go over the regs yourself with a fine-tooth comb, see if you can figure out a loophole, but my guess is that they've got you on this one." "What are they going to do if I refuse? If I just ignore the letter?" Ray chuckled grimly. "You're opening up a whole other can of worms there. What they'll do first is hit you up with fines. That'll go on for quite a while, until the total is an outrageous sum that's almost impossible to pay. Then they'll call in their lawyer and put a lien on your property."
"Can they do that?"
"Oh, yeah."
"Are you speaking from experience?"
"They haven't done it to me, not yet. But it's been done around here, and I've known the people. Believe me, it's not pretty. If you can't find a legitimate loophole or find some way to argue your way out of this with the board, I suggest you start office hunting." Barry spent the rest of the afternoon poring over their copy of the CC&Rs, but to no avail. He called Mike that night, who called someone else who supposedly knew someone on the board, and though neither waivers nor petitions of appeal were mentioned in the association handbook, he was hoping to find someone in authority to let him slide. No such luck. He went to bed that night angry and frustrated. If he'd known he wouldn't be able to write in his own home on his own property, they never would have bought a house in Bonita Vista, he told Maureen. No matter how beautiful the scenery might be, this defeated the entire purpose of moving here, and if they hadn't already sunk so much money into it, he'd put the damn place up for sale and put Utah in his rearview mirror. She didn't argue, didn't agree, remained silent, and they fell asleep on opposite sides of the bed, not touching. In the morning, Barry once again tried to wade through the dense doublespeak of the CC&Rs, hoping the fresh perspective of a new day might grant him insight and allow him to see something he hadn't before, but if anything, the association's case looked even more airtight than before. Maureen put a hand on his shoulder. "Find anything?" she asked. He touched her hand, gave it a squeeze, last night's simmering hostility forgotten. "Not yet," he said. "So what's the plan?" He shook his head. "I don't know." Jeremy was a lawyer, and Barry considered calling his friend for some free advice, but he thought about what Ray had said and decided to hold off for now. He had a sneaking suspicion that he might be needing a lot of legal advice in the future. Barry put away the handbook and stared out the window at the trees. He wondered if he might be able to set up a little office in their storage unit, and he drove down to Corbin to check. As he'd known, the small space was completely full, piled high with boxes and furniture and all the extraneous crap they could not fit into the house. He stopped by the office on his way out and asked the old man behind the counter if it would be possible to rent another space and use it as a workroom. The old man shrugged. "No law against it, I guess. But you'd have to keep the door closed except when loading and unloading. Company policy. And there's no lights inside and no electrical outlets. Gets pretty hot in there come June and July." He squinted as if visualizing something and shook his head. "Now that I think on it, maybe it ain't such a good idea." Barry nodded. "Not a bad thought you come up with, though. Storage units rented for office space. Somebody could make a fortune. Not here, though, not in Corbin. Maybe in St. George or Cedar City." "Thanks for your time," Barry told him. He got into the Suburban, looked out the dusty windshield for a moment, thinking. Realistically, there was only one option open to him, and he drove down to the real estate office, poked his head inside the trailer. "Is Doris here?" The skinny woman seated behind the desk nearest the door called out, "Boss!" And a second later, a familiar face peeked around the corner of the conference room. Doris saw him and smiled. "Hey," she said. "How's it going?" "Fine. Give me a minute, will you? I'm sending a fax to one of the sellers. You can sit down at my desk there," she pointed. "Or you can..." "That's okay," he told her. "I'll stand. I'll just be a minute." Barry glanced around the office, saw an autographed photo of Pat Buchanan in a frame on one of the desks, amateur paintings of fish and wildlife on the paneled walls. Doris emerged from the back room. "Sorry to keep you waiting. Is this business or pleasure?"
Business, he said, caught off guard.
"Just teasing. So how do you like living in Bonita Vista?"
"We love it," he said.
"No problems?" she smiled. "How do you like the Homeowners Association?"
"Well, sorry I had to soft pedal that, but it's my job." "That's kind of what I'm here about."
"What can I do for you?" she asked sweetly.
"I need an office. The Homeowners Association says I can't work at home. It's against their rules and regulations, so I have to find someplace else to write. I was wondering if there's a small room or something I can rent in town. Maybe a..." She put a hand on his arm.
"Oh, I've got just the place. It's right in back of the coffee shop. Used to be a teapot museum, if you can believe that. Old man Pruitt, who owned a lot of land in these parts some years back, had a wife who collected teapots. Antique teapots, China teapots, teapots from Russia and all over the world. Well, she got this idea in her head that she wanted to open up a teapot museum.
I don't know who she thought would come to visit it. There aren't exactly a horde of tourists passing through here, and even if everyone in town came to see her collection, which not all of them did, it wouldn't take more than 2 days. But old man Pruitt built her a little building and set her up. It was hardly ever open, but she kept it until the day she died. That was back in the 80s. It's been empty ever since. Want to go over and take a look at it?
I'm not looking to buy anything, Barry told her. I just want to rent.
That's what I'm talking about, Sugar. Bert from the coffee shop bought that property off Old Man Pruitt in case he ever wanted to expand or build a bigger parking lot or something. That little building's just been sitting there empty ever since. And I bet if we made him an offer, he'd take it. He probably hasn't thought about it for years, and if he found out he could make a little cash on that shack just by doing nothing, he'd jump at the chance.
She smiled, picked up her keys off the desk.
Come on, let's go talk to Bert.
The coffee shop was only a block away, but Doris still wanted to drive rather than walk, and Barry figured that for an old real estate trick, an effort to ensure the customer would remain in her clutches and at her mercy until she decided it was time to let him go. But he got into her Buick without complaint, and the two of them drove down a narrow dirt back road rather than the highway, a long cut it seemed to Barry, but one that allowed Doris the time to fill him in on Bert's eccentricities and convince him that it was smarter to stay silent and let her do all the talking. It was mid-morning, after breakfast but well before lunch, and the only customer in the coffee shop was a sour-looking old man eating eggs and toast at the counter. Doris waved to the teenage waitress.
Lurleen, your daddy here? Just a sec.
The girl disappeared into the kitchen and emerged a moment later with a short, skinny man sporting a crew cut and wiping his hands on a dish towel.
Bert,
Doris called out. The man nodded, no discernible expression on his face.
Doris?
I got a man here's interested in renting Pruitt's Teapot Museum from you.
What?
He looked genuinely puzzled.
I thought you were interested in making some extra money.
Always.
Well then, Mr. Welch here is a writer, lives up in Bonita Vista. The Homeowners Association won't let him write at home, so he's looking for an office, someplace he can set up shop and work on his books. I knew you had that old museum sitting empty, and I thought the two of you might come to some agreement.
She touched Barry's arm again in a way that seemed overly familiar. Barry looked at her, and she smiled at him. There was a flirtiness that had not been there in Maureen's presence and which made him slightly uncomfortable. He should have brought Mo with him, was not sure why he hadn't, and he glanced quickly away.
What are you thinking? Bert asked. Money-wise.
The question was addressed to Doris. They hadn't discussed amounts, hadn't even speculated on a range, and before Doris committed him to something he was not willing to pay, Barry spoke up.
Why don't we look at the place first?
That's a fine idea,
Doris agreed brightly. She turned her smile on Bert.
Want to let Lurleen hold down the fort for a few minutes while we go on back and check it out?
Bert grunted noncommittally, but put down his dish towel.
Don't worry, Daddy,
Lurleen said, smiling. She nodded toward the old man at the counter.
I can handle this crowd.
They walked through the kitchen and out a back door. The building was indeed small, Barry saw, the size of their master bedroom. But it had windows, shelves, a built-in counter, and electrical outlets. Most importantly, there was an adjoining closet-sized bathroom. Neither the water nor the electricity were turned on, and Bert said that Barry would have to pay for both, but at least they were hooked up. A giant cottonwood tree provided ample shade, and on the side of the building opposite the coffee shop, a green grassy meadow stretched all the way to a hill and the tree line.
So how much would you say it was worth?
Bert asked. Barry was about to say he'd be willing to pay $100 a month plus utilities, when Doris quickly stated, $50 a month. It was an offer, not a beginning bargaining point, and the flatness of her voice made it sound as though this were a ticket-or-leave-it proposition. She walked slowly around the room.
A lot of work to be done here, and Mr. Welch will only be using it to write in. It's not like he's a lawyer or doctor renting a first-class suite with all the fixings.
Bert nodded.
$50 a month's reasonable.
Doris held out her hand for Bert to shake.
Thanks, Bert. We'll go back to my office and discuss it, and I'll call you back. If everything's Jake, I'll get some papers drawn up, and we'll seal this agreement.
I can kick you out any time, Bert warned.
I bought that place because I want to expand, and if I need more parking lot or have to add on to the restaurant, I'll kick you out.
Barry nodded.
I understand.
Okay, then.
In the car on the way back to the real estate office, Doris laughed.
Kick you out? That's a hoot. Old Bert probably forgot he even had that place until we showed up and mentioned it to him.
Thanks for stepping in there, Barry said. I was about to offer $100 a month.
I thought you might go high,
she smiled.
Didn't want you to cheat yourself, even if it would have upped my commission.
I can't commit to anything yet, he told her. I have to call my wife first.
Call her? Bring her on down. Look at it. Think about it. Discuss it. That shack ain't going anyplace. And no matter what Bert says, he has no other plans for that place. You're a godsend to him. Take all the time you need.
Thanks, Barry said.
Doris winked at him. Just doing my job, sugar. Just doing my job.
16. In a way, the Homeowners Association had done him a favor. As much as Barry hated to admit it, working out of an office had opened up both his life and his work. He found that he liked spending his day in town, liked the contact with local characters, and the sense that he was part of Corbin's day-to-day life. His new novel had undergone a shift since he'd gotten out of the house, acquired depth and texture and a real-world sensibility. It was more mainstream now, more accessible, less insular and self-referential, and in an indirect way, the Homeowners Association was responsible. He smiled wryly. Maybe he should thank them on the acknowledgments page. Outside the window, a red-headed woodpecker swooped out of the cottonwood tree and disappeared into what looked like a microscopic hole in the eave of the coffee shop. It was a hot day, and the cicadas were out in force, their chirruping overpowering the fan hum of his computer and fading all other noise into background static. Inside, shaded by the massive cottonwood's thick foliage and giant branches, the air remained pleasant and temperate, but he could see shimmering heat waves distorting the air above the dirt road, and knew that out in the open the temperature was anything but pleasant. Barry saved what he'd written, shut off his computer, leaned back in his chair, and swiveled around. It was pretty neat having an office. He liked it. Ray Bradbury had an office. A lot of famous writers did. And there was something official about it. He felt more professional, more successful, his writing suddenly seeming more like a vocation than an avocation. Besides, he and Maureen were getting along better now that they were out of each other's hair, and no longer had to share computers. He checked his watch. Nearly noon, although his stomach could have told him that. Grabbing his wallet from the desktop, he locked up and walked across the field to the coffee shop. He'd taken to eating lunch here each day rather than going home or bringing something he'd made himself. He was not the only one. The coffee shop seemed to be a favored hangout of many locals, and the food was not half bad. Besides, it couldn't hurt to patronize the business of his landlord. He might be able to stave off potential rent increases, or get some free work done should the plumbing act up or the roof leak. Barry pulled open the smoked glass door and felt the welcome chill of air conditioning. The place was already starting to fill up, but his usual table by the restroom was free, and he waved to Lurleen, grabbed himself a menu off the counter, and sat down. He felt awkward the first time he'd come in here. He was not one for eating alone, was not one of those people who was comfortable without companionship in social settings. Being by himself in restaurants or movie theaters always made him feel self-conscious, as though everyone were staring at him, and though intellectually he knew that was not the case, he'd been sorely tempted to get his food to go and eat it in the office. But he forced himself to sit down at the counter and order lunch, and while he was fidgety and ill at ease, he managed to get through the meal unscarred. He returned the next day. Barry was not good at meeting new people, at injecting himself into existing groups or conversations, but he was lucky enough this time to have Bert do it for him. He was seated at the counter, eating a cheeseburger, pretending to be proofreading a manuscript, and behind him, two old-timers were talking about Kingdom of the Spiders, a William Shatner horror movie that had been on one of the Salt Lake City stations the night before.
The movie had been filmed in Camp Verde, Arizona, which was where one of the old-timers was from, and he was tearing apart the topography of the film, complaining that in one scene Shatner was driving away from the ranches he was supposedly heading toward, and that editing and selective shooting made the movie's downtown seem very different from what it was.
"It wasn't that they just shot the flick at Camp Verde," the old man said. "I could understand that. But they claimed it was Camp Verde. It wasn't supposed to be no made-up town or nothing. They were pawning it off as a real place."
"This guy here writes scary stories like that," Bert said from behind the counter, nodding toward Barry. "Maybe he knows why they do things like that." Barry hadn't attracted any attention in the coffee shop on his first visit, had been ignored by the other customers as though he wasn't there, but all of a sudden the old man and his cronies took an interest in him, and Barry found himself the subject of serious attention. One old-timer even reached into his shirt pocket and put his glasses on in order to see better.
"I rent him the old museum out back," Bert went on. He sounded almost proud. "He writes his books back there."
The old man who'd been complaining about the movie squinted at him.
"You a famous writer?" he asked.
Barry laughed. "I don't know how famous I am, but I make a living at it."
"What's your name?" one of the other men asked.
"Barry Welch." There was shaking of heads all around.
"Never heard of him," someone said.
The complainer pushed his chair back, walked over to the counter, held out his hand.
"Name's Hank Johnson. Pleased to meet you."
Barry smiled, shook the hand.
"Likewise." "So, as a writer, would you do something like that? Put in false stuff about a town even if you knew it wasn't true?"
"Writing is lying," Barry said. "We make things up, and if we put in real places or actual events, we change them to suit our story. We don't care about reality." Hank nodded.
"Makes sense. Ticks me off, but it makes sense."
"A helpful hint. Don't watch Kingdom of the Spiders if you're looking for realism." The old man chuckled.
"You're all right, son. Come off of that counter there and eat with us. I got a lot of questions, and I don't like standing here this close to Bert. It's disturbing."
"Hey," Bert growled. Barry picked up his plate and glass and followed Hank back to his table. Ever since then, he'd been treated like one of the regulars, one of the gang, and that was another reason he was glad he'd been forced to rent the office. There was something gratifying about being a part of the workaday world rather than remaining apart and aloof, isolated in his hillside house in his gated community. It appealed to his egalitarian democratic sense and made him feel as though he were a better person for it. Lurline came over and took his order, barbecued chicken sandwich and a Coke, and he nodded to Lyle and Joe over at the next table.
"Where's Hank?" he asked.
"Can," Joe said simply.
Hank emerged a moment later, wiping his hands on his pants. He nodded at Barry, smiled.
"Howdy, son. Hot enough for you?"
"Temperature's fine out in my little shack."
"Lucky bastard."
Hank sat down in his usual spot at the adjacent table, gestured to Lurline for some more iced tea. At the next table over, Lyle cleared his throat.
"Another dog got poisoned last night."
"No shit."
"Bill Spencer's lab, Bo. They found him face down in his bowl, tied up right in the front yard. Guzman's going to do an autopsy on him this morning."
Hank shook his head.
"Never liked Guzman. I take all my animals to Ryan. He's my pet and livestock vet."
"Yeah, but Guzman'll be able to tell what killed him."
"We already know what killed him. What's this make, 4 dogs this year?"
"Somewhere around that."
6 pets total if you throw in Abilene's cats," Joe offered.
"I never even heard about this," Barry said. Hank nodded.
"Been going on for a while. It's not regular, not consistent, but every month or two some dog will be poisoned. Always happens in the middle of the night. It's bad enough for a man to come out and find his animal dead, but when it's kids that find the body, like with the Williamson girls..."
Hank shook his head.
"It just ain't right."
"And that walking piece of crap hitman won't do a damn thing about it."
Hank snorted.
"Hitman. There's a proper candidate for lynching."
Barry chuckled, but stopped when he realized that he was laughing alone. Hank wasn't serious, he wasn't proposing murder, but the sentiments behind the statement were anything but joking,
and he understood, looking around the room, just how different he was from these people. This was a whole other world. And while he might be friendly with Hank and Joe and Lyle and some of the other regulars, he was just a visitor here. A woman at one of the other tables spoke up.
"Why don't the sheriff just arrest those bastards?"
"That's the $64,000 question." Barry was incredulous.
"You mean the sheriff knows who's doing this?"
"Everyone knows."
"Who is it?"
Lyle looked at him as though he were a moron. "Your homeowners association." The answer came as a complete shock, and Barry's first instinctive reaction was one of guilt by association, no pun intended. He was suddenly certain that everyone in the coffee shop held him at least partially to blame for the pet killings, but a quick look at the faces of his lunch buddies convinced him that such was not the case, that he was considered one of them, not one of them, and though he was filled with relief, he still felt at fault somehow, as if he had betrayed the people around him.
"The Homeowners Association," he said dumbly.
Lyle nodded. Hank spoke up.
"It's true."
The expressions on the faces of the other men and women were grim. Barry wished he could dismiss such a charge out of hand, but it was too easy to believe, and he had no trouble picturing a pet-killing committee dressed all in black, spreading out through Corbin in the middle of the night to do away with dogs. He thought of the dead cat in the mailbox, thought of Barney.
"But why would they do that?" he said aloud. "What's the point?"
Hank shrugged.
"They're trying to extend their influence into town, trying to make us all into a part of their little kingdom. Corbin's unincorporated, and they want to take over. We have no town council, so they figure they can call the shots."
"But no one's buying into it," Lyle said. "Their master plan just won't fly here."
Joe nodded.
"So they're trying to force their lifestyle on us. They don't allow pets, so they start killing our pets.
Next they'll be painting our houses for us, cleaning up our yards."
"Let 'em," someone called from a booth near the door. "I'd appreciate some free maintenance work."
There were scattered chuckles, even Lyle smiled, and the mood seemed to be broken. The tension that had been gathering over the coffee shop dissipated, and Lurleen brought over his Coke.
"Sandwich is coming," she said.
"I'm gonna get me one of them motion detectors," Joe said. "Put it on in the backyard where I keep Luke tied up. Anyone comes snooping around in the middle of the night, blam, all the lights will go on, and I'll come out with my shotgun blasting."
"Not a bad idea," Hank said. "Maybe everyone with a dog ought to do something like that."
Lyle nodded.
"Maybe they should."
Barry walked back to his office after lunch, feeling strangely unsettled, and though he immediately fired up the old computer and sat down before it, more than an hour passed before he finally started writing again. He closed up shop late, time-fooled by the summer sun, but when he got home, Maureen was still down in her office, knee-deep in calculations. She was auditing the payroll expenses for Corbin Title and Mortgage, and she informed him that she didn't have time to cook dinner and wasn't in the mood for any of the limited number of dishes he knew how to cook, so he was on his own tonight.
"No problem," Barry said.
He went upstairs, microwaved a frozen pizza, and sat on the deck eating, watching the sun start its slow descent toward the canyons. After depositing his plate and glass in the dishwasher, he told Maureen that he was going to go for a walk, get a little exercise, maybe stop by Ray's for a minute.
"Say hi to Liz for me," she said.
"Will do." Barry hiked up the road to the top of the hill. It was still light out, but the world was suffused in an orange glow, and from this angle the Dysons' house looked like it was on fire, so bright was the reflection of the setting sun in the home's windows. Ray must have seen him walking up, because his friend was on the porch steps drinking a beer and waiting to greet him as Barry trudged across the gravel driveway. Ray smiled.
"Hey, stranger. What brings you up this way on a school night?"
"The Homeowners Association." Ray's smile faded. He nodded toward the front door.
"In or out?"
"The weather's nice. Let's stay out here."
"Want something to drink?"
Barry shook his head. "That's okay. I just had dinner." Ray took a sip of his beer, sighed.
So what's happened now?
Barry told him about lunch at the coffee shop, the story of the poisoned pets, and the conviction of the locals that the homeowners association was responsible.
So what do you think? He asked. Do you think they're really killing off pets?
Ray thought for a moment.
I doubt it, he said. It's not that I think such a thing would be beneath them. It's just that I don't think they have any interest in things outside of Bonita Vista. The rest of the world could go to hell in a handbasket for all they care.
As long as we're still safe up here, as long as the houses are painted the proper color and no one has an extra car in their driveway, all is right with their world.
But like you said, they have the sheriff in their pocket. Maybe they want to expand their reach. Take over Corbin.
Maybe, Ray said doubtfully. But Hitman's in their pocket only when it comes to Bonita Vista matters. I'm not defending those assholes, you understand. But I really think that their interest lies here, that their only concern is what happens in our little area. They might kill our pets, but I don't think they'd cross the border and go outside their territory.
He paused. You know, it's not power they want, not specifically. It's power over Bonita Vista. It's hard to understand, at least for normal people like us, but they really do seem to have some sort of primal territorial feeling about this place, some sort of myopic localized interest that forces them to focus on Bonita Vista and Bonita Vista only, to the exclusion of every place else. The land under a gated community possesses evil energy and has some sort of hold over its residents, making them do horrible, unspeakable things. Barry smiled.
Sounds like the plot of one of my novels.
Ray nodded seriously.
You're right, he said. It does.
I was joking.
I know.
But Ray was still not smiling, and he sipped his beer as he walked over to the side of the house and looked down on the town of Corbin, where lights were beginning to flicker on against the coming darkness. Barry watched him. His friend had been acting odd lately. Nothing specific, nothing overt, nothing concrete. But there'd be a vibe at strange moments, at strange times, that made Barry sense something was wrong. He'd hesitated to mention it before for fear that it was some sort of marital trouble, some problem between Ray and Liz, but that did not seem to be the case, and he cleared his throat and stood next to his friend.
Is there anything the matter? He asked awkwardly.
Nope.
He tried humor.
You don't seem your usual happy-go-lucky self.
Ray waved his hand dismissively, still not looking at him.
It's nothing. I'm just tired.
Barry let the matter drop. Maybe it was nothing. If it wasn't, well, no doubt his friend would talk to him when he was ready. It wouldn't do any good to push.
Ray looked away from the edge, glanced over at Barry.
Liz wants to have another party, a neighborhood get-together for all us outsiders. You and Mo game?
Sure.
Ray shook his head.
I'm getting too old for this shit. Never thought I'd say that. Never thought I'd end up one of those old farts who just likes to sit on the couch and watch Jeopardy. But damn if that's not what I'm turning into.
He sighed.
Getting old sucks. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
I always knew it did, Barry told him. His friend was silent for a moment, and when he finally spoke again, his voice was soft.
You don't want to cross them, the Homeowners Association. There's no telling what they're capable of. The best thing you can do is just stay out of their way.
Something did happen, Barry said.
No, nothing did. Something could have, but nothing did.
Then it's one thing for an old-timer like me to be defiant, have a high profile. They know me. I've been around for a long time, and I'm tolerated. But someone new, someone like you...
But nothing. I'm not afraid of those bastards.
Maybe you should be.
Why?
Ray sighed.
Just try to stay out of their way, he said.
If they come after you, go at them full force. Use everything at your disposal to defend yourself. But don't go looking for trouble, that's all I'm saying. Don't put yourself in harm's way for no reason, for pride or stubbornness or principle. It's not worth it.
Don't worry, Barry said.
I'm not stupid. I know you're not. I just want you to keep that in mind, though. Just keep that in mind. They were late to the party. At the last second, Maureen got a call from a panicked client back in California who had just arrived home to find an IRS audit statement in his mailbox, and it took her 10 minutes to calm him down and reassure him that there was nothing to fear, that everything for the past 5 years was in order, and that this was merely a random audit, not a red flag situation. "Don't worry," she told him. "I'll take care of it." She spent the next 10 minutes quickly accessing computer records and looking through her file cabinets to make sure that what she'd told him was true. So they were a half hour late getting to the Dysons. Liz answered the door. She gave each of them a big hug. "We were wondering what happened to you two." "Just some last-minute business," Maureen said. Liz winked at her. "I understand." "What does that mean?" Barry whispered as they walked into the living room. "Does she think we were fighting or fucking?" Maureen hit his shoulder, gave him a stern look, then turned on her smile as she headed over to the punch bowl. Barry felt a strong, masculine hand slap his back. He turned to see Frank Hodges holding a Heineken and grinning hugely.
"How goes it, bud? Haven't seen much of you since you took over the Teapot Museum."
"There aren't any teapots anymore. It's now home to perverted sex and violence." Frank laughed heartily, slapped his back again.
"Glad to hear it. That's the way things ought to be."
He motioned across the room, where quite a few people seemed to be mingling by the windows.
"Do you know Kenny Tolkien?"
The name didn't ring a bell. Barry shook his head.
"I don't think so." "Oh, you gotta meet Kenny."
Frank led him through the crowd and around the couch. "He's the only person here with a job cooler than yours. Kenny is a career consultant to rock stars, right, Kenny?" The man standing before them, elegantly holding a glass of red wine, was tall, gray-haired, and distinguished-looking, save for the gaudy blue patch over his left eye. He smiled.